Hi, you're listening to Talking About Organizations, a podcast about management and organization studies, where we read and discuss foundational texts and key ideas that inform the way we think about organized work today. Talking About Organizations is a community resource supported by our listeners. To find out how and learn more about our program, visit our website at www.talkingaboutorganizations.com. We also thank the Management Learning Journal and the European Group for Organizational Studies for their wonderful support. Now on with the show. Welcome to episode 80. In this conversation, we explore a critical essay by Sumantra Ghoshal titled Bad Management Theories Are Destroying Good Management Practices, published posthumously in Academy of Management Learning and Education in 2005. This is part one of the episode where we will discuss the article and its critique of business and professional education. To get the text and other associated readings, please go to our website at www.talkingaboutorganizations.com.
Hello, everyone. This is Miranda calling from London, UK.
This is Samantha calling from Mexico City.
This is Tom calling from Carlisle, Pennsylvania in the United States.
Hi, this is Sarah dialing in from London in the UK.
Welcome, everyone, and welcome especially to our newest cast member, Sarah Ottner, who is joining us from the UK. Welcome aboard. Good to have you.
Thank you. I'm glad to be back.
Yeah, that's right. You joined us in episode 61 and did, that was the Dan Brass episode, who did such a marvelous job that we asked her to come back on a more regular basis. So this is terrific for us. We are continuously growing. Sarah, why don't you just give us a little bit of background about yourself, what your interests are, et cetera.
Well, I'm very glad to be back. It's great fun, as I hope the listeners will agree. So I am an assistant professor in organizational behavior in the Department of Management at Kingston Business School. Kingston Business School is a research and teaching university in Greater London area, out near Wimbledon in the green Surrey heartlands. My research interests are in economic sociology and organization theory, but I am an experimental psychologist by background. So I have quite a methods toolbox that I use. And everything I look at is about social status and prizes. I look at major prizes like the Nobel Prize, book prizes, philanthropic donations as a type of prize, and especially big prizes that are backed by philanthropy as well. So hopefully we will look at adding a couple more like that to next year's list.
We'll certainly see. I think we're going to be starting off today with a little bit of a smaller prize, which is like the business school diploma. Yeah, indeed. This is kind of what we're going to be looking at today. As this episode is going to be released, the business schools all across the world, hopefully in as close to a post-COVID environment as possible, are going to be returning to welcoming the next batch of students and churning out, hopefully, tomorrow's future business leaders. In that spirit, understanding that education is a tough profession to be in general, we wanted to take a look at some of the criticisms of business schools. We did Herb Simon's study on business school design back in episode 29. But, this time, we're going to take a little bit more of a critical look at them, based on an article that was published in the Academy of Management Learning and Education back in 2005. It's by Sumantra Ghoshal, who is providing a neat critique that's well explained in the title. Bad Management Theories Are Destroying Good Management Practices. You know, we'll get into the text more deeply. Just in a nutshell, what he presents is not a naked commentary on business schools. This is a very well-reasoned one. He models or provides a model for how the construction of theories that are proffered in the business schools that become a big part of the curriculum are basically translating their way into practice, but producing some absolutely horrendous results. And he tries to unpack the theories and the reasoning behind those theories, some of which are ones we've covered in this program and are, Nobel Prize, he takes on Williamson and the transaction cost model, for example. It basically says how the way that it's presented to students is it's not promoting good corporate behavior and may be contributing significantly to some bad practices. So with that as context, I'd like to turn it over to Miranda for a moment to talk about Dr. Ghoshal himself, because he is a very, very interesting figure.
Yes, so maybe before discussing the text, it's important to talk a bit about the author of this text, Sumantra Ghoshal, so we can really sort of start looking at his biography and picking up a couple of elements which give us a flavor for the person behind this piece of writing. Sumantra Ghoshal was born in 1948 in Calcutta, India. His scholarly home sits within the area of international management, and his book, Managing Across Borders, The Transnational Solution, written in 2002, was listed by the Financial Times as one of the most influential management books. It is important to note at this point that, unfortunately, Ghoshal passed away in 2004 before the publication of the article. Actually, the first footnote of the writing at the bottom provides thanks and acknowledgement to his son, his secretary, and his student for being able to put together the writings and make this a publication. Despite his legacy in the area of management, his first degree was actually in physics. He was a physics major at Delhi University, but he also had a degree from the Indian Institute of Social Welfare, and that was in business and management studies. After some time spent in industry, he moved to the US thanks to a Fulbright Fellowship and a Humphrey Fellowship. And there he was awarded both a PhD and a DBA, which is beyond amazing. A PhD from MIT School of Management and the DBA from Harvard Business School. Two awards which he worked on in parallel on two different topics, so two distinct dissertations. I am really beyond amazed for that. He also founded, and I find this a particularly interesting point, which pays tribute to the legacy that he wanted to provide and especially to give back to his home country. So he was the founding dean of the Indian School of Business in Hyderabad, which again pays tribute to this character.
And I might also add that he did pass away on the younger side. I mean, when I read this article, and as I think will become clear in the text, this is not the sort of an article that one writes at the end of their tenure as sort of like a, you know, sayonara, you're all messed up and I'm going to go off to pasture. This read to me like the type of an article written by somebody who was in the process of writing out a plan of action. He's not just criticizing. He is proposing that in some future time we should move in a particular direction. And I think it conveys an idea that he wanted to be part of that movement, wanted to be part of the leadership of that movement. He didn't say that directly, but you sort of get that sort of a sense that this was a step one of a bigger plan that unfortunately others are going to have to carry on instead. So we can go ahead and get a bit into the text itself. And we just I'd just like to start with figure one, which is on the second page, and it essentially lays out his big argument, his big critique. A whole series of theories, like two factors, are leading to some problems. What we've talked about in this podcast before about how we love to do quantification of things, scientific management, and a lot of that. Well, where does that come from? How come scientific management and the like has permeated into the business school literature? It is, he claims, that it's built on what the schools can mathematically model. And so it's at the center of this figure, he basically, I'll just read it off, excessive truth claims based on partial analysis and unbalanced assumptions. And the unbalanced assumptions come from this idea that the theories that would be most useful, most practical for students, are ones that are the most quantifiable. Feeding into this are two things. One is the pretense of knowledge, which is essentially, we take a very positivist view of things, set aside all those things we can't quantify, and we just assume as a pretense that that is going to be sufficient in order to provide the foundation for any real useful business theory. And then the other one is he actually drew this from another text, but the ideology-based gloomy vision, which is a rather cynical view of human nature. present in a number of the theories or the assumptions that are built into the what the business schools are grabbing onto and teaching as opposed to what they decide to set away. The result is the knowledge and the vision contribute to the preference for choice of quantifiable models that ignore things like ethics, morals, the complexity of social interactions. All of that becomes off to the side. We're training business students to think cynically about what it is that their purpose is for running a business or working within a large corporation. And it's reinforcing. It becomes a self-reinforcing habit because the ones who come back to the business schools with experience say that this is what works. That's what ends up happening is that it just sort of, it reinforces itself and it becomes more normalized. And what he's proposing to do is to break that cycle.
For me, there's a step that's missing above this diagram, which is the foundation for business education and its primary offering, which is the Master of Business Administration. There are generally two reasons that students come to a business school for a graduate degree, for a master's degree. The original, which is that they want to level up within their same organization, or a related organization and need a certification in leadership and management and need this finishing school for managers, for professionals, in order to get to the next level. And that's why the average age of a US MBA student is 27. It used to be 29, it's now 27 and falling. The second reason most of our students come to us at business school is they're at a pivot point. They're at a change point in their career. They don't want to stay where they are. They don't want to necessarily stay in their sector, in their field, but they don't know what else they might do. And in a typical two-year program, they will get inspired in year one and they will be set on their new way in year two and polished by the time they graduate. And every classroom has students from those two different inspiration points in the same classroom to be taught the same way and to be taught the same subject. And that's where you have an issue with setting it up in a funnel this way. They might have conflicting exposure to or interest in many of these. So your point about coming back and telling us that's the way it is, that goes to the point in the article that's talking about the practicing managers adopting theorists' worldview. So that's the big arrow in the middle here. That would be wonderful, right? That's what we're always chasing, is having research impact, is saying that out in the real world, our theories are out there, people are using them, it's making change. So in that sense, if that's happening, and then as you said, Tom, people come back to school and tell us we were right, we were wrong, so we change the model, we shift our teaching, that would be exactly what you would want from a research-informed school. So I think there are a few pieces of this that might be correct, but not have the same consequence that the model is telling us that they do. And then there are other pieces that might be correct for some students at some points in their education and in their career. And we just need to understand that we meet them where they are and we take them where they're going to go. And that theory and science and research and modeling and what can be modeled can be managed isn't necessarily wrong at each of those different points. We need to get that match correct.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, the challenge, of course, is that, he's trying to generalize. I think it's, it serves a good purpose for laying out the structure of the paper and also, at least being general or, applicable enough across a wide range of business schools, because every business school is very different. I think it's more of an expression. I mean, it's more of an explanation than, say, a rigorous model, I would say.
Yeah, and I think another thing that we should probably also mention is that he's writing as a response to recent or relatively recent scandals, right? So the Global Crossings, Enron, Tyco, and he's trying to kind of provide an explanation or at least admit kind of part of the responsibility in how we've been training executives and managers.
So Samantha, I think it's really interesting that you situated it in its time and place. But I'd like to go back to the very introduction of the paper and read it a little bit differently and see if the audience could tell the time. Corporate scandals in the United States have stimulated a frenzy of activities in business schools around the world. Deans are extolling how much the curricula focus on blank. New courses are being developed on blank. Old, highly laudatory cases on X and Y are being hurriedly rewritten. What more must we do? The faculty are asking themselves in grave seminars and over lunch tables. So with those very specifics removed, doesn't this sound to you exactly like the discussion we're having about sustainability and responsible business metrics and responsible business teachings and the movement that within the academy itself, but also in business education more widely about sustainable and responsible business and business education?
Absolutely, Sarah. I think one of my questions that I wanted to give to the group was how much do we think these kind of issues have changed in the last 16 years? Because yeah, like just to add to the courses that you list, we also have, you know, issues of diversity, gender equality, even, you know, if we look at the work on kind of wellness and making work more meaningful and things like that, I think, yeah, definitely we could extend and read this article is still very much relevant to what we're seeing today.
Yeah, now that said, I do wonder, though, that there's when we actually dive a little bit deeper into that figure and talk about some of the things that he charges in the course of the article, it does get pretty specific to those corporate scandals. And I say that because in the first page, in courses on corporate governance grounded in agency theory, Jensen and Meckling, 1976, we have taught our students that managers cannot be trusted to do their jobs, which of course is to maximize shareholder value, and that to overcome agency problems, managers' interests and incentives must be aligned with those of the shareholders. I won't go further there. That was a particular problem in Enron, but was also a kind of a symptom of other corporate behavior ills of the time, because maximizing shareholder value became the grand shiny object upon which everybody was measured in practice, that it led to the encouragement of behaviors that, you know, ends justify the means. We're going to maximize shareholder value no matter what it takes. And in the process of doing so, now we start tearing at the social fabric. We start tearing away from some of the ethics or whatever, because the magic bottom line number is what is the only thing that counts. And it created an environment that, yeah, we could say that managers aren't, you know, at any particular point in time, managers probably don't get trusted. They may just not get trusted for different reasons or what have you. That particular charge was written very context specific, I felt. Adaptable, but it was a product of its time.
Just wondering something out loud and sharing this thought with you. Isn't this idea of sort of, you know, teaching that we shouldn't trust managers, isn't it really just at the end of the day, just a teaching which is a bit too shallow, a bit too sort of straightforward and simplistic, when actually a more rounded delivery, a more rounded presentation and development of a module would present the theory and its importance with all the conditions attached and the critiques around it?
I'll leave it to Sarah and Sam. I'm not in a business school per se. I took what he was saying as sort of like a second order effect of just simply where the theory takes people. Because you know, nobody goes into a profession saying that we should distrust, but we do cloak that in the form of checks and balances, for example, or something like that. But anything overdone can be taken to an extreme. And I think that's kind of what he was getting at, was that because is the theory what's really bad here? You know, this is kind of one of my questions as I was reading the article. Is it really the theory? What's the theory trying to do? What's the theory trying to explain? There is a general problem of trying to map theory to practice that I think that if you take the theory or you apply the theory the wrong way, you can certainly encourage some bad practices.
Yeah, I was just going to say, I don't think it's trust in the sense of the fox is guarding the hen house. I think if you look at it from the perspective economics would take about rational man And it's this, as you explained, the setup of what solves the self-interest if that is in conflict with the organizational interest, which would win out. And the other thing is obviously the difference and the focus in this article on governance is about making itself worthwhile or making the case for itself. So instead of just saying that governance is here to stay and we need to clean it up or do it a bit better, in that sense, it is reminding us, why do we have the structures of corporate governance we do? Why do we have auditing? Why do we have policies about terms and compensation? Why it is the way it is and where and when it can be improved. And I think that's different than a level of trust. And especially as someone who's usually working at the level of the individual analysis or meso-OB, and trust being established, destroyed, repaired, maintained between two entities. I don't think we can talk about trust at this level. There are too many different players involved to establish that rapport, to establish that reputation. So I think if we think about it instead as incentives, which is in this article, that language is in this article, as agency, that language is in this article as well. And then in the way when he starts to get into causality and methods, trying to model it, the parts of a model before the arrow and after the arrow. I think then we can have the same conversation that the article probably intended we would if we replace those instead of talking about trust.
Yes, and I would only add, going back to Miranda's question, whether it's, and what Tom was saying as well, whether it's the theories that are bad or damaging, or if it's the way that we're teaching them. And I think another thing that came to mind when I was reading the article is how actually constrained we are when we're teaching. Like, you cannot, you know, like this ideal world where you explain the theory fully and then examine all of its assumptions and you know, acknowledge all of the criticisms and think about alternatives. Like, I don't know how realistic, I mean, it's ideal, and I think we should definitely be doing that, but I don't know how realistic it is when it seems like what we research or what we learn when we're doing research might be very complex, but then what ends up going into the classroom might be a very kind of diluted version of that. So that's another thing,
I think. Yeah, I totally agree with the points raised by Sarah and by Samantha and also by you, Tom. I think one of the main things that I would like to throw out there as a sort of an issue to reflect upon is what I think is missing in this article, which is, as Sarah mentioned, what is the purpose today of a business school? And obviously it's a bit difficult to put it into one clear box because there's a diversity of business schools and of students. But from my experience, which is at the moment based in the UK, what is happening is that business schools and universities, actually universities as an entire block, are encouraged to be increasingly student-centered. And with this, I'm not making a case that it's wrong. There are a number of reasons why it should actually be so, but it's the way we are placing students at the center that possibly needs to be questioned. And it's the measures that we are taking to be able to identify what is the success of a business school education. And if we're really looking at developing people that can just set up businesses that stay afloat, maybe this is a bit too simplistic. And maybe if we can find refined measures of developing more critical thinkers, then actually also the teaching would be geared towards developing critical thinkers. And in that sense, the second issue that I sort of throw out there to the room is related more to the research, because at the end of the day, business school teaching is informed by research, and that's sort of something to really bear in mind. But what is happening is, I think, another difficulty in terms of measuring and finding indicators that define concepts in a certain way. So we're defining success performance in a certain way, but because we define it in that way, translated profits, I don't know, you name it, in terms of quantities in particular, consequently we're aiming and we're gearing towards those measures. And I think this is something to really reflect upon.
Those are all excellent points, Miranda, and it makes me wonder, it's possible that this feedback loop, this way that we measure ourselves that reinforces what we teach, does it cause us to emphasize or bias towards certain types of organizations, and overlook others.
During my thesis work, I really tried to emphasize the importance of so-called everyday entrepreneurship, small businesses and entrepreneurs and micro businesses and the self-employed. And the reason why is that there is actually a lot of them, more than what we think.
Yeah, I'll definitely take your word on that. Now, the difference between populations you listed and the traditional corporate environment have to be very, very significant. And certainly that leads us to thinking about, you know, what is it that we are reinforcing? It kind of gets into a part that I wanted to talk about, which is Ghashal's mention about the pretense of knowledge. So his argument is, in a nutshell, that, if you're a scientist studying the natural world, there is a phenomena out there that you're studying. Now, how you develop a theory over what causes that phenomenon or how you model that phenomenon does not in any way change the phenomenon itself. Nuclear physics, the theories of nuclear physics, have no impact on how atoms and molecules interact. Whereas in the social sciences, there's much more of a loop. There's much more of a feedback such that, indeed, you know, like you were saying, Sam, how we decide what we're going to take back into, you know, what research provides back to the field. Well, in this particular case, because research in management, research in leadership, research in anything in the human sciences has an impact on how people react. I mean, a management theory is put out there as a theory of how things work or whatever. Well, then that gets picked up and it influences the behavior of managers, and behavior of faculty members, potentially the behavior of students, because if we anchor on that, we shape our behavior and then it becomes sort of a self-fulfilling prophecy. The theory changes the phenomenon by its existence. It's interesting that he brings in Hayek. He brings in several other authors who said, you know, a lot of the same thing many years ago. It says that if we don't pay attention to that, it's very easy for us to become so enamored with our theory that we just go off on the wrong tangent.
Yes, I really like that observation, Tom. And actually, I think one of the questions that I also had after reading this is if we can avoid it, because it seems like just the very nature of the phenomena that we study, it's, you know, it's stuff that it's relevant for people that are practicing. So any and all theories and concepts that we develop will eventually kind of feed back into the settings that we study, which might not necessarily be a bad thing if we start to acknowledge that. But then is this just a problem that we're always going to have to be dealing with?
So I think if we look at figure two, we take Tom's lead and we move to the next figure. So the way that it's set up on the right-hand branch, natural sciences versus humanities, of which social sciences is under, and obviously he's following the much older explanatory texts and adapted, I find it very interesting that causal explanation for the social sciences has a question mark, where it's guaranteed fundamental for the organic and inorganic sciences and fundamentally excluded for the aesthetic fields. Especially because recently we know that there's been an explosion of visual methods and artistic methods in qualitative management research. So the idea that that was a clear no, and then the social sciences were questionable about causal explanation, is very in tension, I think, with the fact that the functional explanation box also has a question mark, and the intentional explanation box is a guaranteed yes. Which is to say that the model that this is based on is only looking at human intention. And then if it later in the article, he's talking about psychology and sociology, which, as I said, were are my two background disciplines. And it says even practitioners of sociology and psychology, so not scholars, just practitioners, the starting points of which as academic fields were defined by the recognition that human behavior can be shaped by factors other than conscious, rational self-interest. So right there, again, without naming names, setting up that tension with economics. Sociology and psychology explain everything else that economics doesn't. And making that space in the business school for everyone under the same part of the table in figure two. So that tension means that you're trying to define your niche, you're trying to define your space. Again, you're trying to justify the existence. So of course your contribution isn't clear.
This also, I think, it sets us up for the nice discussion that he has about the gloomy vision. When we're talking about, the explanations and the causality, it just naturally with any of us who work in the, in complexity knows that causality is almost impossible to determine. But because there's somewhat of a desire, as he puts forth that there's kind of a desire to try to find something that can be proffered off to the field to say that here is something that is workable, reliable, useful, then you've got to create some assumptions in order to try to cut away from all of the complexity that prevents you from having the ability to make a causal explanation for some particular social phenomenon that A causes B. If you do A, you will get the result that you want. Getting back to the point about why do we have a business school? If we think about it in terms of being able to provide people capable of practicing in the real world to build better companies or whatever, if you didn't have that purpose in mind, you wouldn't really have much need for a business school. So in order to get things to the point where we can say we can provide things to students to turn over into practice, we've got to give them tools that have to be built on some assumptions. And unfortunately, most of the assumptions, according to Ghoshal, most of the assumptions that are built into these models seem to take into account the worst of human nature, such that, in essence, we want to take the ethics and the morals out of the equation because they're messy, they're icky, they're impossible to understand, they're very conflicting. I love the way that he asks this these questions here on page 83. But what is the connection between ideology and pessimism? Why is the ideology pessimistic? He offers Friedman as providing the answer. He labeled the ideology as liberalism, cautioning at the same time, however, that his use of the term referred not to its corrupted association with concepts such as social welfare equality, but to earlier emphasis on freedom. And at the heart of this ideology lie two convictions. A major aim of the liberal is to leave the ethical problem to the individual to wrestle with, and that the liberal conceives of men as imperfect beings. There comes your gloomy vision. If the corporation does not have a ethical or moral responsibility, then what it's left with is the ability to manipulate mathematics, which it can control. It can offer the promise of causality. It can offer the promise of improvements in practice or whatever in ways that reality, all of this complexity, this fluffy stuff, doesn't. And you can go ahead and just cast it aside. But the other thing is, of course, if you consider that men as imperfect beings, then this is where the models can become almost the end to themselves, where we don't really want to have alternative perspectives or something to challenge the model. The model be fixed. The model be everything. The model be end all to be all. And that drives towards, say, very ends-driven kind of decision-making. As he puts it, led to some of the scandals that we've been discussing.
But if you take up that mantle, if you try and answer the original provocation of how do we stop this from happening, I found in reading this paper, I found that initial inspiration separate from where the rest of the essay took us. It took me a long time to get down through ideology and to get through where do I fit on this timeline or this diagram between agency theory and network analysis and as outside of management theory, and to hold on to that nugget of purpose to repair, to self-repair, to repair and make sustainable. It's the beginning really of sustainable education. And I have to say that I lost that thread. It seems like two separate essays together, and I know Miranda gave us the history of why that is, but within myself, I struggle to solve the next great step.
I think there's also something to say in terms of how business schools develop over time, which I don't have that much historical memory on, but what I feel from my studies, going back quite a number of years, is that sometimes it's the same old theories that continuously pop up. And I'm just wondering, where is the incentive where is the encouragement more than incentive? Because I know that these sort of words flag up other areas of interest, but where is the encouragement to keep up to the pace. And I think sometimes, especially in the area of entrepreneurship, it's more just listening out for the students and for what they are interested in. So in particular, in the conversations around sustainability and social enterprise, really giving spaces for those students that have those interests and giving them opportunities to exercise them, to adapt them, and to really refer to other theories or measures or just areas of interest, actually. So that is something that I feel is important to introduce in the equation. And something else that I feel as an early career academic is that when you enter a place at this level, it's very difficult to introduce big changes. Often you inherit modules. Often you're lucky if you can adapt the teaching materials, but there is very little space and opportunity and reflection to say, okay, how old are these things and are they up to date? And maybe sometimes it comes from us as members of staff. It definitely comes from the students, but it also comes from an ongoing reflection as to where are we compared to the outside world.
Well, it's also an even tougher step to say that a particular theory really is at its core wrong, especially if it's a theory that is, no kidding, out there, has earned some major accolades and is widely accepted as being, you know, seminal. We know that, you know, just going back to scientific management, it has certainly had a lot of criticism at the time. It has had a lot of criticism ever since. The criticism has morphed over time. But the fundamentals are essentially thus that in the absence of anything else that can be expressed simply as a way of understanding performance and incentives to greater performance, we just simply don't have anything else. I think part of the thing that he's bringing into this is that this is in a lot of ways a theoretical discussion that's more than about theory. It's about how do we decide what is a useful tool? And if something has been so useful, then any of the other idea that comes in order to unseat that idea has got to be proven, whatever that means, proven to be more useful. Otherwise, stick with what is tried and true, stick with what works. If we're going to talk about disrupting a curriculum, that's going to be one of the big challenges. You know, you got to convince people that the new way is going to be better when it looks awfully messy.
But that's what's so fascinating about the part of the original model that we've already discussed, the part about theories influence practice and managers adopt theorist worldview. So from the two other sister approaches to knowledge, so if you say from elsewhere in the social sciences, you're looking at a very Foucauldian surveillance. And if you say from elsewhere in the humanities, in the arts, you're looking at a Pygmalion effect. In both of those perspectives on structure, observation, and change, there are positive and negative feedback loops, but there are ways for the system to affect its inhabitants, its agents, as well as for agents to affect the system. And for me, that's where I have this issue that they're connected in this model to negativity. And that this is the only bit on this, otherwise in a boxes and arrows diagram in AMR, would be causal or moderator on this causal arrow between excessive truth claims and unbalanced assumptions and other negative assumptions that become real through double hermeneutics. Already, there, as Miranda's saying, there isn't any room. There isn't any room. There isn't another effect on this arrow. There isn't an unlabeled box. There isn't any room, is exactly what Miranda's saying.
Well, he seems to think that the answer is essentially that this has to be fixed from within. I mean, he puts in towards the end, I won't find the exact quote, but it's essentially, if this is a problem to be solved, it's got to be solved by business school academics. Which is interesting. I mean, it certainly makes sense because, who is ultimately in charge of the curricula, who is ultimately in charge of fulfilling the purpose of the school. But if, you know, you have this potential for, you know, this entrenchment of ideas, this cycle, that's this self-perpetuating cycle, can it really be done on the inside? Are there some, what do y'all think?
Well, I think we've kind of mentioned related points before, but another thing that he doesn't address necessarily on the article, and it's kind of looking at the other side, because here we're looking at kind of the responsibility of researchers and teachers, basically. But also understanding the business school as a, you know, it's, it relies on a certain business model. And people that go to business school is because, you know, as Sarah was saying at the beginning, you have these two types of students. And so at least one of those types expects very clear answers and steps and points to follow in how to be a better manager and how to have a better business. So I guess, I don't know, I see two problems in the critique that Gojal is kind of providing. One of them would definitely be, and maybe we can discuss this in the next part, what is good theory, what is a good management theory and what is not a good management theory. And I think the other challenge, which you've also talked about just before, Tom, is how we teach and how we communicate these theories, and what Miranda was saying before as well, you know, how much time we can spend in providing kind of a very critical full picture of these theories, also acknowledging, I think, how they emerge, which is something else that Gojal doesn't do in this piece, which is, you know, a lot of these theories emerge from observations and trying to provide explanations for behavior that we're observing. So they might not be universal, or they shouldn't be trying to explain everything exhaustively, but they are based on some observations of real life.
Again, I think, again, going back to the discussion we had on purpose of business schools and business education, I think one of the reasons that this has landed in AMLE and has landed across our desks as something for us to pay attention to and something for us to address is the underlying power that businesses and therefore business school graduates have. There's a reason that we're not having this discussion in PhD programs of economics or in MFA programs in art schools. And for better or for worse, that was the situation in 2005. That is a comparative situation in 2021. And therefore, it's the to whom much is given of him or her, much is expected rule. That is what our responsibility is at the point of this article. And then we have to say to ourselves, given that, what next? So all, you're right that teaching and hoping that a fraction of our students will apply our lessons, let's say for an ethics class, which is what was discussed in the front of this article, the idea that by forcing them through an ethics class as part of their core requirements in a graduate degree in business is the final time for an ethics education for a practicing manager or a leading professional is reductive. But it's what we had and what we still have at the time. So I agree with you that it shouldn't be that the answers are internal. But as we discuss in responding to scandals and responding to corporate wrongdoing situations, it is what we had and have.
I wonder if I'm just jumping sort of future topics for the next parts to discuss. But I just wonder about this issue of boundaries and responsibility. And with this, I'm not saying that lecturers and academic staff within business schools, you know, they do their thing in there and it has no impact or no sort of ripple effects. There are ripple effects, but it's also true that someone who goes through a business school education comes with a certain baggage, with motivations, with a background, but also there are other things that happen afterwards that are other backgrounds. And I just think maybe it's not the theories, it's not the assumptions of the theories, but it's more taking a greater stance as a business school in front of these scandals, in front of changing trends, and maybe just taking a stance that is not only in the curriculum and not only in the topics, but also in the principles, in the values, in the way things are conducted. And I think in some places we've got conversations around ethical, good citizenship, sustainable behavior. But in other topics, in other areas, we've got a lot around sort of student experience and these aspects. And I just wonder if it's actually just maybe taking more ownership over this responsibility and acting more in terms of behavior towards sort of future students and former students, and just be making it part of the identity of the organization as a business school. Just an open thought there.
And that concludes the episode for today. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed the conversation and found it valuable. If so, please consider subscribing through your favorite podcast service and you won't miss an episode. We also welcome your feedback, so if you liked or didn't like something, or have a correction or suggestion for us, please get in touch via Twitter, Facebook, LinkedIn, or our website, www.talkingaboutorganizations.com. Finally, we would like to thank some wonderful people for supporting the show. Sarah Audner, Leon Prieto, Hadi Shaheen, Marshall Reiner, Alice Barbosa, Thomas Roulet, Heiko Schmidt, Barton Friedland, Guldem Kara Mustafa, Roberta Bernardi, Marina Timmer, Bernard Hogan, Eddie Hunsinger, Fiona Knight, Peaks Craft, Timothy Paul, Willy Leidon-Wirte, Gabriel Van Bunnen, and Clara Lux. It's easy to support the show, and all you have to do is go to our website, where a donations button will greet you. Thank you for listening, and we hope to see you for the conclusion of this episode here on Talking About Organizations.